from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, a coalition of doctor and consumer groups says Americans get too many unnecessary medical tests and treatments. The Choosing Wisely initiative has just released a list of tests and procedures that they say doctors should prescribe less frequently. But some of the recommendations, for example, that patients debilitated with advanced cancer shouldn't get chemotherapy, are likely to cause concern. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Yesterday, 9 medical specialty boards recommended that doctors perform 45 common tests and procedures less frequently and urged patients to question these services if they are offered to them. 8 additional specialty boards are expected to follow suit, and estimates as high as a third of the $2 trillion annual health care costs are spent on unnecessary hospitalization and tests, unproven treatment, ineffective new drugs and medical devices, and futile end-of-life care. This forum hour, we want to take up the topic and get response analysis, including response from you. And with us in studio is Catherine Lucy, MD, Vice Dean of Education for the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, also chair of the American Board of Internal Medicine and a trustee of the ABIM Foundation. She spearheaded this initiative, and welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Well, let's find out from you what we're talking about here. It's a little bit, on the one hand, exciting to many people to hear that maybe a lot of unnecessary treatment maybe cut back, and on the other hand, maybe scary.
Mm-hmm. People are always worried when you talk about whether some care should not be given. But the important thing about this campaign is it's not about rationing. It's not about restricting care that patients need. It's about asking physicians and patients to talk about whether tests are indicated and will help them. And our specialty societies that we collaborated with through the ABIM Foundation initiative have carefully evaluated what's done across the country and sort of said, there are some things we've gotten in the habit of doing that perhaps do not always help the patients that we're aiming to serve.
Of course, we spoke with somebody from the Heritage Foundation. They said, of course, this is rationing of health care.
And
you say what?
It's not rationing of health care. Rationing of health care is when you deny needed care to patients for whatever reason. Rationing of healthcare means that patients could get better being given a particular drug or subject to a particular test. This is about tests that in many circumstances do not improve quantity of life, do not improve quality of life, and potentially could harm patients. And I'm very proud of the specialty societies who took this brave step forward and said, not everything we do is good.
Boy, brave in many ways, because it's going to hurt the pocketbook of many doctors. In fact, there's already some howling along those lines, isn't there?
People can howl about what almost anything that's put forth about healthcare these days is a very hot topic. But physicians as professionals really want to do what's best for their patients. Like any other individual, though, sometimes we fall into habits, and this campaign is suggesting we need to critically evaluate those habits. This is not about denying these tests. This is not saying that these tests don't make a difference for some patients. It's saying that many times they don't. For instance, the nuclear cardiologist said 45% of routine screening cardiac procedures, stress tests using nuclear radiology, are done for people who don't benefit from those tests. So why do them? That's the question we're asking.
Well, it's also true, I guess, with EKGs for people just routinely during a physical exam without any sign of a heart attack or anything like that, with MRIs for back pain. I mean, there are so many things that make you wonder, why wasn't this done a long time ago?
You know, that's an excellent question. And I think part of this has been stimulated by the general conversation about healthcare and our unsustainable healthcare system. We know that by 2020, healthcare will cost somewhere around $4.6 trillion. And estimates have been made that up to a third of that $4.6 trillion is wasted on either unnecessary or duplicative cases. And as physicians, we want most of all to have a sustainable healthcare system that allows us to serve patients. So I think the general conversation about healthcare over the past several years has really stimulated us to think closely about what we can do as a profession so that we can continue to serve our patients best.
And our guest again is Catherine Lucy, Vice Dean of Education at UCSF School of Medicine. She also chairs the American Board of Internal Medicine and is a trustee of that foundation that spearheaded this initiative. Give us a sense, though, of, I mean, for example, there's been a good deal of concern about people with advanced cancer shouldn't get chemotherapy.
Yes, that's probably the most difficult set of conversations physicians have to have with patients is what to do when someone is reaching the end of their life from a malignancy or from another chronic condition.
Just any end of life.
Yeah, any end of life issue. And that's where I think most people get concerned about rationing. What patients really want to know is that their doctor is treating them as an individual. And what we're encouraging people to do is to have a conversation, a really in-depth conversation between physicians and patients that pays attention to the data about what's likely to help.
And patients need to be kind of pushed and nudged to do this in many instances, don't they?
I'm surprised at how often patients welcome a more in-depth conversation about this. Very often, they come into an encounter with a set of expectations, and the physicians just take them for granted that they know enough to make those choices themselves without any further conversation.
Or the physicians are too pressed for time to have these kind of conversations.
Sometimes it is time-related, and sometimes it's a level of discomfort. And we're hoping this campaign will increase the physician's comfort so that they can say to patients, look, I know you've heard from your aunt or your next-door neighbor or your boss that this treatment might make a difference or this test might make a difference. Let's talk about what groups of physicians have said about this, and let's compare it to your values and your needs and see if we can come to a rational decision. Sometimes that shared decision-making conversation, which is what it's known as these days, shared decision-making, sometimes that shared decision-making will result in patients getting more treatment or more tests. But oftentimes I found in talking with patients, when you really lay out this information for them and they know this is not about you making a decision financially to support yourself or your insurance company, they're more than willing to go along with what's the best recommendations. And I think the fact that specialty societies have endorsed these lists should give the patients and the physicians a lot of comfort.
One of the concern that you hear from some skeptical voices that this is just the insurance companies taking another detour. The costs are going to be put onto the doctors and the hospitals. In fact, the doctors are going to, as I said, be affected by this in their pocketbooks. And it's another way of helping the insurance companies.
You know, that's what I think is beautiful about this campaign is it's driven by the profession. And we started off with a statement that professionalism for physicians includes doing the right thing for right patient at the right time, and as well as stewardship of valuable resources. And the physician societies, not the insurance societies, the physician societies said, when you remind us of that, we can critically look at our performance and say, yes, we can do a little bit better. No physician gets up in the morning and sort of says, how do we make more money on our patients? They get up in the morning and say, how do I best help my patient? And this is information which we believe will help them continuously make those right decisions.
Okay, Catherine Lucy, Vice Dean for Education, UCSF School of Medicine. Are any insurance companies on board with this?
We haven't actually engaged insurance companies in this conversation. We've engaged the specialty societies, which are the professional organizations that represent physicians in different specialties of medicine. And you see that came from the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Society, American College of Physicians itself, the American College of Radiology, the Academy of Allergy and Immunology. This is a physician-driven initiative, not an insurance company-driven initiative.
You've got the oncologists on board. You've got the cardiologists.
Nephrologists, kidney doctors.
Nephrologists and gastroenterologists.
Gastroenterologists, I mean,
a lot of
yeah.
specialties.
Yeah.
I want to get John Santa into this discussion. He's an MD. He directs the Health Ratings Center for Consumer Reports, which is partnering with the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation on what has become known as the Choosing Wisely Initiative, and he's with us from the nation's capital, D.C. Dr. Santa, good to have you.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, I guess the initial question I have to ask you is, Dr. Lucy was saying that patients, for the most part, would like to have these conversations with their doctors, and yet there are impediments to getting those good conversations going with patients, aren't there?
Well, there are. First of all, I think at Consumer Reports, we would definitely agree with Dr. Lucy's statement. Our surveys of consumers overwhelmingly says that they want to have those kinds of conversations, and they are more and more concerned about cost. They're concerned about safety, and they want to understand. Frankly, the way I've put it is I think many consumers want to move up to more of an adult relationship. Certainly some of them may not, but our audience definitely wants a doctor that's engaged, wants to be sharing in those decisions, as Dr. Lucy says.
And wants to ask questions or needs to be perhaps nudged to ask those kinds of questions? I mean, is there a different mindset here? Is it really what I'm getting at?
That's right. Consumers are afraid to ask questions about money because our surveys show that they're worried that when they do, physicians might take that as they're willing to accept less care or less high-quality care. So they're trying to figure that out. And one of the reasons why we're so excited about this is we think that work that comes from both physicians and consumers will give many consumers a permission to ask those difficult questions. We see this as very much of a shared challenge, that sometimes consumers are asking for tests and treatment that is not for them, and sometimes doctors are suggesting it for some of the reasons that you mentioned earlier. So, you know, in our case, for Consumer Reports, this is what we do. For 75 years, we've told consumers about virtually every industry in the country and identified products and services that work well and products and services that don't. And in healthcare, we've kind of been reluctant to admit that that exists. And I agree, this is an extraordinary moment because these nine societies have stepped up to this, and we're really excited to be part of it.
And we're talking, are we not, about billions of dollars that are spent on risky procedures? Billions?
Oh, I think we're talking about tens of billions. An analysis was done of some work that the ABIM Foundation funded, that the National Physician Alliance did, preliminary to this, and they identified 12 topics that were primary care-oriented, and those 12, they estimated, would save around $6 billion a year. Folks have asked in the last couple of days, well, how much do you think these 45 will show and or save? And, of course, the devil's in the details. But, you know, my sense is you're talking about tens of billions. As mentioned, when you have a $2.5 trillion industry, that may not seem like much, but to us, it's a great start.
Yeah, we kept hearing for years how healthcare costs were just going to continue to go up, 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 and, of course, non-sustainable going up and up. And now suddenly we're finding out that actually, and this sounds like a win-win on the face of it, you know, the billions of dollars can be saved. John Santa with us from Washington, D.C., is director of the Health Ratings Center for Consumer Reports, which is partnering with the American Board of Internal Medicine, the foundation on the Choosing Wisely initiative, which is really what we're talking about here. Maybe... and it's, by the way, on our website. You can just go to our website and find out really all you need to know in terms of the Choosing Wisely initiative and what they're putting out there for people to know. And it's good news. It's bad news. But it's kind of sad in a way, isn't it, that it's taken so long here, John Santa?
Well, it is. I think we tried to do this in the 90s. I was around for that. I'll take some responsibility for it. I worked in the insurance industry then. I worked for a physician group during some of that period. And for a variety of reasons, we failed to get it done then. Now we've got another chance. And I can tell you that in that era, I certainly met with professional societies at a state level, and they weren't comfortable doing what these nine have done. That's why, to me personally, I just think what ABIM has facilitated here is just extraordinary. And it's great, from my point of view, to be on the consumer side to help with it.
And let me go back to you, Catherine Lucy, because what about the concern that you'll have kind of one-size-fits-all as opposed to the individual patient being given the kind of attention that you're calling for here? Or to put it in another perspective in terms of apprehensions that have come up, fear of malpractice suits.
So to address the first part of that question, I would say that one of the reasons we chose this approach, that is calling on physician societies to build on their foundation of professionalism and identify ways to really help bring this dialogue about what's necessary and what's unnecessary into the equation with the patients. We felt that going in that direction, rather than going to insurance companies and sort of saying, there's evidence that this doesn't work, don't pay for it. That's a problem. If the insurance companies drive this and say, we're not going to pay for these tests, then you get into that one-size-fits-all situation. But when we talk to our physicians and they say, you know, there are circumstances when this doesn't work for patients, and we encourage them to have those conversations more often, then what happens is you get a much more individualized set of care. I'd say now we have one-size-fits-all. If you go into a doctor and you have a cold and you want antibiotics and they give you antibiotics, that's one-size-fits-all. If, on the other hand, they thoughtfully listen to your symptoms, do a comprehensive physical exam of the relevant areas, and then sit down with you and sort of say, you know, your signs and symptoms just don't meet the criteria for getting antibiotics at this point, let's wait a few days and see how things happen. That's much more individualized, patient-centered care. And so,
a doctor wouldn't necessarily say, you've got mild sinusitis, so I'm not going to give you antibiotics.
We're going to say you have sinusitis. Studies show that since you've only had your symptoms for 2 days, it's most likely to be viral. And antibiotics at this point will not help you. And in fact, could hurt you. There are consequences of taking antibiotics that you could get a secondary infection that's much more serious. So let's talk about a different approach, and let me hear what you say about that.
And Dr. Santa, the elephant in the room here may be observations or concerns about treatment after everything seems to fail. We're talking about end of life here and fee-for-service causing problems.
Well, that's right. I think your appreciation of the American Society of Clinical Oncology topics was appropriate, as is the appreciation for what the American Society of Nephrology has suggested around dialysis and end-stage renal disease. Those are two very important complex chronic diseases, and each of them has a topic that basically says there are points in those illnesses where a very complex conversation needs to take place in terms of whether initiating treatment or continuing treatment is appropriate. We're comfortable writing about that. We're looking forward to that. We didn't choose those topics initially to write about. The antibiotics and sinusitis is a bit easier. But we're going to take that on because consumers need to know that's reasonable on the part of doctors to engage you. And it will be individualized. Again, we definitely aren't doing this in hopes that insurance companies or the government will take a one-size-fits-all approach in response. If that happens, we'll be very upset from a consumer point of view.
Well, we're talking about medical treatment here. We're talking about the fact that about one-third of medical spending is for unnecessary treatment. And I'm going to open the phone lines now and invite you who are listening to this program to join the conversation. If you have questions or comments, we certainly welcome your involvement. And you can join us now. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to call us now at 866-733-6786 if you have questions or comments or reactions in general to the Choosing Wisely initiative, which is certainly getting a good deal of attention. You can also email us any comments you might have or questions to our email address, which is forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment, or post questions or comments on our Facebook page. And let me go back to Dr. Catherine Lucy, who is really involved in this from the get-go. What were the ties to national health care, other than what you've touched on already? I mean, obviously, that's a lot of the catalyst, isn't it?
Well, I think the conversation about health care that was stimulated by the health care reform and the Affordable Care Act was a stimulus to revisit this issue. As John said, back in the 90s, we looked at these issues and didn't get very far. And I think to a large extent, it's because we drove it from the insurance and payment perspective. We're driving this campaign from the professionalism perspective, recognizing that people go into medicine to serve patients, and they want to serve their patients well. And we were so pleased that our specialty society partners stepped up to the plate and said, now's the time for us to really revisit this issue and remind people that we have a responsibility to ensure that healthcare is sustainable in the United States.
Well, John Santa, here's a listener named Liz who writes, if approximately 30% of medical costs go to unnecessary tests, treatments, etc., and I've read that approximately 30% goes to administrative and advertising costs of private health insurers, then by my reckoning, we should be able to eliminate 60% of healthcare expenses by eliminating unnecessary and unhelpful procedures and replacing private insurance with single-payer medicine for everyone. Bingo. Problem solved.
Well, we have
Someone who used to be in the insurance industry, I'm just interested in getting your response to that.
Yeah. We have a very expensive system. Compared to other developed countries, we have a very expensive system. And those two components that the reader points out are two of the major reasons for that. And we don't get our money's worth. There's no question other developed countries get much more of a bang for their buck by avoiding some of the issues that the questioner identifies. Our challenge is we live in a country that prefers, quote, market, unquote, solutions. And coming to consensus around something other than that has been very, very difficult. My own belief is that it's likely a single payer plan could deliver more and better care. But whether that's true or not in the United States, we may never know, because culturally it seems pretty clear we won't go down that road.
No, and culturally, reports, I'm sorry, culturally or say, politically.
Well, let me just say Consumer Reports looked at that issue long and hard, and were a supporter of health care reform and the law that passed, and we're an enthusiastic supporter because we think more people need to have access to health care in this country.
And we're going to hear more about Choosing Wisely from the initiative from Consumer Reports, no doubt. And I want to thank you, John Santa, for joining us for this segment. Again, John Santa is an MD. He's director of the Health Rating Center for Consumer Reports, which is partnering with ABIM, American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation, on the Choosing Wisely initiative. And we're going to take a quick break here. When we return, we'll continue with Catherine Lucy, and we're going to talk to a bioethicist as well, and we'll hear from you, our listeners. Again, easy to join us. You can do it by phone at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, though all lines are busy. But other ways to communicate with us or grab a line when it becomes available, email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment in the report. And the link to the report is on the website, and you can also, of course, go to our Facebook page. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A coalition of doctor and consumer groups say that Americans get too many unnecessary, sometimes even harmful, medical tests and treatments. And the group has just released a list of treatments, 45 of them, that they say doctors should prescribe less frequently. But some of the recommendations, for example, that patients debilitated with advanced cancer shouldn't get chemotherapy, have caused concern. We're discussing the initiative and whether patients really do want fewer tests. And you are certainly welcome to join the conversation. We are speaking with Catherine Lucy, who's here with us in studio, Vice Dean for Education at UCSF School of Medicine, many years at Ohio State, now new to the faculty there, and chair of the American Board of Internal Medicine and a trustee of the ABIM Foundation that spearheaded this initiative. We also spoke to John Santa of Consumer Reports, MD, who is partnering, that is, Consumer Reports is partnering with the ABIM. And John Santa is a director of the Health Rating Center. And we want to welcome David Magnus onto the program. He directs the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the Thomas A. And is Thomas A. Raffin Professor of Medicine and Biomedical Ethics, and also Professor of Pediatrics at Stanford University. And good to have you with us, David Magnus.
Thank you for having me.
This seems like, on the face of it, a win-win. How does a bioethicist look at it?
Well, I think it definitely is a move in the right direction, trying to empower patients to ask questions so that unnecessary care isn't provided that could potentially be harmful and is at a minimum wasteful is a good idea. Trying to create expectations on the part of physicians not to offer these things in the first place and to communicate better with their patients. All of these, I think, are definitely positive steps in the right direction, but they also occur in a context that makes it challenging to get very far. For one thing, this is all fairly low-hanging fruit, and there's a lot of things that are done that are not very effective, and obviously only a limited number of things can really be part of this really short list.
Well, could I get you to estimate, if there are 45 things on the list, how many should there be?
Well, if we look at most of the individual societies, they chose their top five often out of much larger lists. So if each of the societies had a list of 15 or 20 things, that starts to get you some sense of what the potential would be, even for the fairly simple and straightforward things where there's consensus.
Well, forgive me, Dr. Magnus, but I want to mention again that listeners can go to our website and look at the 45 overused tests. If you haven't already done that, just go to kqed.org/forum and, again, click on the segment. But do you see any other downsides to this?
It's not that I think there's a downside. I think it's just it's a move in the right direction, but there are other things that need to be done as well, and there are larger forces that make it challenging for things like this to really have as large of an impact as we might like. The most important one is, of course, the fact that the way we pay physicians has a huge impact on their behavior. When physicians are paid fee-for-service, you often have a much larger incentive and therefore a much larger occurrence of unnecessary tests. When physicians don't get paid in that way, you have far, far less utilization. And so regardless of whether you have a single-payer system or an insurance system or who pays the check, the way in which physicians get paid has a huge impact on what winds up being utilized.
And you would suggest what in the way of reform?
I think fee-for-service, this is very, very unpopular in the world of medicine, but fee-for-service is incompatible with a sustainable and a medical system that provides adequate care. So that's one thing that I think has to be eliminated. Atul Gawande in a very nice piece in New Yorker made the analogy that if we paid, when we have houses built, if we paid plumbers for every faucet they installed and we separately paid electricians for every electric socket that they put in, we'd find houses with hundreds of bathrooms, tons of sockets and electric switches, and the houses would be incredibly expensive and fall down every 5 years. And then we have a debate about whether we'd be better off if we changed who wrote the check. So fee-for-service, in which we pay each individual specialist separately for each thing that they perform, is almost by its nature guaranteed to produce unnecessary treatments.
Dr. David Magnus with us by phone, directs the Center for Biomedical Ethics and is Thomas A. Raffin Professor of Medicine and Biomedical Ethics at Stanford, also Professor of Pediatrics. Would you know perhaps, Dr. Magnus, I'm going to get our callers on here, but a listener named Greg sends us an email and says whether the frequency of unjustified treatment test procedures is higher in the U.S. than in other industrialized countries like England and Japan. Do we know?
We do know that. So it certainly is much, much higher in the U.S. than in other countries.
Yeah.
So we have higher utilizations. And even within the U.S., the frequency of these unnecessary tests varies, as I said, depending on how patients get paid. So Kaiser, for example, much, much less frequently orders unnecessary tests than patients who have standard health insurance.
We'll bring our callers on, and our first caller is Christy. Join us, Christy. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say thank you for bringing up this topic. I'm a nurse, and I agree with Dr. Magnus that this is a start to a conversation that doctors and patients can have, and I hope that it continues to proceed into further areas. And I haven't had a chance to look at the tests online, but I just wanted to know if any of these specialists were in the pediatric area, and because pediatrics is, I think, as a whole, a harder area to try to say, oh, we're not going to do such and such tests, because parents dictate a lot of what they feel like their children should be receiving.
Well, pediatrics is Dr. Magnus's area, but Dr. Lucy, do we have pediatricians on board yet? Or?
We don't have specific pediatric recommendations in this initiative, and we may going forward. There's another 8 societies that will be joining us in the fall. But I do want to commend our pediatric colleagues. In the past, they've tackled the issue, for instance, antibiotics for simple early ear infections, and have come out strongly, the American Academy of Pediatrics, about appropriate decision-making around that very common common situation. As you know, a parent with a child with an ear infection believes antibiotics is right. And the American Academy of Pediatrics was really probably the first to come forward with that type of a recommendation. And so even though they're not here, I think they're thinking along the same lines.
And we've been talking, Dr. Magnus, about the effect of the insurance companies. Obviously, it's inescapable in this kind of conversation. But what about the effect of Big Pharma here? I mean, particularly in terms of prescriptions that may be unnecessary, and yet there has been a kind of alliance in many instances through the years between Big Pharma and physicians who are in private practice.
Certainly, a driver of expenses is the fact that there are many, many things that the pharmaceutical industry does to try and obviously, enhance their profits, and that means creating new drugs. And then trying to sell them. And there are a lot of different things that they can do to try and influence physician prescribing habits. You know, gift giving is very common. At Stanford, we banned all gifts. We banned all free lunches. Then there's a general movement to try and limit the amount of influence pharmaceutical companies have. But when
you have to give up those trips to the Caribbean and all that?
Sorry?
You have to give up those trips to the Caribbean and all
that? The Caribbean. The AMA has actually had already for quite a while said that it was problematic for physicians to take gifts that were of significant value, but even de minimis gifts turn out to be extremely effective in influencing behavior. So even things like pens or things that seem innocuous on their surface actually have a potentially significant impact on prescribing habits. So it really is important to try and avoid the common problem that, you know, the newest drug comes out as a new treatment for something. It's very, very expensive, but it's actually approved from the FDA on the basis of a placebo-controlled trial. There's no evidence that it's better than the cheaper existing treatments that actually are much better established, but the reps come through, they persuade physicians to go with whatever's new and shiny. And so even though the evidence is that this isn't necessarily, there's no evidence that it's better, and given the lack of a track record, it's arguably something that shouldn't be first line, you wind up seeing prescribing habits that wind up using more expensive drugs inappropriately. And again, it's one of the reasons why organizations that have tended to be very concerned about controlled costs, like the VA system and like Kaiser, tended to be the very first to keep drug reps out and to have more control over making sure that it was actually clinical evidence and good clinical decision making that was guiding physician decisions, rather than advertising and influence by the pharmaceutical companies on physicians.
Let me bring more of our callers in. Frank, join us. You're on the air on Forum. Good morning.
Yes. Retired former chief of staff of a major medical center, so I've seen a lot of this stuff. I'd like to just bring up a few points about taking a good history. Back in medical school, I had the great Dr. Lerb, who said, that if you do a careful history, you can make 95% of the diagnoses before the patient even unbuttons his shirt. And here are some examples. I saw a patient who for 4 years had been going to ENT people, had all kinds of expensive things, trocars, you name it, because of a terror. He said the world smelt so badly. And nobody had ever asked him what it smelt like. And when I found out that there were episodes, that they was prickling, et cetera, to boil it down, I did send him for one test, an EEG, because I realized he had epilepsy of the nose system rather than sinusitis, for which he brought in a 2-inch-thick chart. Another patient was screaming for morphine one time. Nobody bothered to take her history, and it was the ordinary lowest orderly in the place who showed me, hey, doc, look at this funny urine. It's dark green. And I immediately saw it was porphyria, and she needed morphine because porphyria puts terrible crystals into the ureters, and the pain is about as bad as pregnancy.
Dr. Frank, if I may call you that, I think your point is particularly well taken about the necessity and the imperative of taking a good history. Catherine, Lucy, get you a comment on that?
Absolutely. I think that these lists, if you read them carefully, you'll see each one says talk to the patient, find out their symptoms, do a careful exam, and then see if the test that we're saying doesn't necessarily need to be done would add anything to that very considered decision-making that a physician goes through in collaboration with their patient. You know, I run education programs for the University of California, San Francisco, and we spend a lot of time helping our students learn to take really outstanding and nuanced histories and do great physical exams. And we need to remind our patients that sometimes that's the best diagnostic test possible. And this literature that these specialty societies have reviewed reinforces that notion.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of your comments on our Facebook page. Sam writes, I especially worry about medical care that might actually harm the patient, such as radiation from unnecessary x-rays and infections from hospital stays. I appreciate that doctors are working to address this issue. And Dave from Danville says, good morning, Michael and panel. It's unfortunate that our public discourse has been so thoroughly hijacked by cynical demagoguery, death panels, etc., that common sense initiatives such as this one that your panel is discussing are politically toxic. Our gratuitous spending on unnecessary medical procedures is doing one thing and one thing only, sending a credit card bill to our kids. Another listener, Anonymous, writes, the problem with this discussion is that it is reflecting a misunderstanding of insurance and how it is directly related to the seemingly sensical idea of cutting down on testing, etc. As a clinical manager, I can tell you that what your panel needs to get is that insurance will not pay for a host of important and vital medical treatments without the further confirmation they unfortunately require from these costly tests. While these insurance companies are not benefiting financially from this needless testing, they will not compensate patients or MDs without such tests, and that is the root of the problem. Your panelists, because they are so distanced from the day-to-day low-paid administrative work that keeps their practices going and serves the patient population as such, just do not get this. Any comment on that, Dr. Magnus?
Well, I can't comment on the issue of whether or not it's always required to do all this testing for reimbursement. I'm skeptical of that claim. If you've got a good, well-documented basis and strong evidence for that's in accord with general standard practice for a treatment, I think you would usually be okay for being able to get reimbursement. But I think one point that one of the callers, one of the commentaries made about communication and the conversation about taking a history raises something else that I think is critically important, which is we spend an awful lot of time in the training of our medical students, and I know I spend some time training them about how to have conversations and what that means, but it's a very, very small part of medical school, and it's a very small part of residency training, and we spend a lot more time on the technical aspects of their training. And the result of that is that the actual communication with patients is probably some of the least evidence-based parts of practice. and yet it's some of the most important. So a lot of the misunderstandings or demands that we wind up seeing that drive a lot of the behaviors that are seen as problematic by asking for necessary tests on the part of patients or physicians offering unnecessary tests or procedures is a function of really a poor communication process. And there's actually a huge amount of data that many people have done, and we're doing some of these studies that show how incredibly poor communication between physicians and patients typically is.
So there has been a concerted attempt to provide more, well, instruction, if you can instruct in these things, or to what degree you can, like empathy and bedside manner. And I know Abraham Verghese, who's a friend of ours who is over there now teaching in the medical school, has been talking about the importance of being tactile with patients. In other words, really focusing attention on the patient.
Work is so important, partly because it's in response to the fact that this has been seen as a, and he himself recognized this as something that's been almost lost, and he's trying to essentially resurrect this as a very powerful part of medicine and something that we're certainly working on. But the data is very clear that this is something that's actually, if you look at actual physician practice, it's something that's actually missing or done in an impoverished way. We record patients, physician encounters and communication, and study those things and see some of the ways in which this is missing.
Well, so, part of it, forgive me, part of the problem, I remember reading a book years ago called Assembly Line Medicine, is that things just move too quickly and there's too much paperwork. And I mean, you know, I hear doctors complaining about that and have through the years here in the program I do. I mean, some of that red tape just has to be cut too.
So there are many factors that produce this. Electronic medical records are great things, but you do, I mean, I see this in our hospital, where the residents, instead of looking at the patients, they go into the room and look at the computer. And so there are many, many things that contribute to this, and there are ways of trying to make it better, but it requires an awful lot of education at a lot of levels. The problem of, you know, patients wanting or demanding chemotherapy that's ineffective at the end of life is the end result of a long process where, at a time from early on when things were more optimistic with first-line chemotherapy, we focus on the positives and don't really engage in advanced care planning and don't take the opportunity to talk about the very real possibility that, you know, at a time when there's a 60% chance of a good outcome, we focus on that and ignore the 40% chance that things are going to go poorly. When you go to second line and now there's only a 20% chance or a 10% chance of a good outcome, they're just still focusing on that good outcome. And then when you finally get to the point where there's no longer anything that can really be offered to the patients, it's not very surprising that they haven't really addressed this issue all along. They've been fighting and going along a certain track, that it's very hard at that point to shift tracks. If there had been better communication all along about the fact that this was a very real possibility, you wind up getting better outcomes and you don't have the demands for ineffective care at the end of that process.
All right, I want to bring another caller on here. I believe it's another doctor calling us from Phoenix, Arizona. Steve, you're on. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to bring up something that really seems to be getting ignored here. A lot of the tests that are done, and you know, maybe in an academic institution, but certainly out in the real world of practice, are done for defensive medicine reasons. I mean, a lot of us who are out in practice know, absolutely know, that a patient doesn't need a test. Your previous caller said a great history and physical can often diagnose the problem. That's absolutely true. The problem is, if something goes wrong, you end up in a court of law. It's not what you knew. It's what you can prove. And what you can prove is quite often limited to what you've tested for. And that's a huge part of practice. I mean, I would conservatively estimate that in my practice, 30 to 40% of the tests that are done either because an insurance company wants them, or, you know, a payer wants them, or more commonly, because you need to be able to defend what you've done and be able to prove what you've done.
Well, we're bringing this up again. David Magnus, I mean, this is kind of unavoidable, the concern over malpractice, isn't it, in this whole picture?
It's certainly a factor, and defensive medicine, things being done because of concerns about liability or risk management, it's certainly a factor. But as I understand it, most of the empirical work that I've looked at suggests that that's actually a relatively small driver in these kinds of unnecessary costs. So it's certainly a factor, but I don't think it's actually a major driver.
And you would agree, Dr. Lucy?
You know, I think that it's a factor that drives physician behavior, and the magnitude of cost is probably underestimated, the magnitude of concern that the physicians have. And so I want to respect the concerns of our colleagues who are out practicing day in and day out. I do think, though, that helping physicians have these detailed conversations and getting really outstanding relationships built so that the patients feel that they got the right care is a step towards mitigating that malpractice risk. These are really advanced communication skills, and they need to be revisited continuously so that patients believe that the physician gave them the care that they needed at that time. And if there's an adverse outcome, literature has shown good communication protects against malpractice suits. And I think one of the things we need to do as physicians and professional societies is incorporate these communication skills in our continuing medical education courses and not just make the education courses about the latest drug or the latest device, but talk about the latest communication strategy to enhance our reputation and enhance our relationship with our patients so that they know they're getting great care even if the care isn't associated with a new test or a new treatment.
Here's a listener from Sacramento who writes, the release of this report that you're now discussing is way overdue, touches on a consumer issue that affects us all, that is, that of excessive costs of medical tests, especially those that cannot be covered by one's medical insurance. In our case, our son went to the emergency room for chest pains to Mercy San Juan here in Sacramento. He was assessed by a nurse or physician's assistant who then ordered a battery of tests, including an MRI. He waited 12 hours to see a doctor to get the results of the test, but was never seen and was further told that the test results would not be sent to his regular doctor unless he waited his turn. Later, we learned that the total cost of this alleged medical care was $10,000, only $7,000 of which was covered by his student health policy. One of the tests, the MRI, was $5,000, and we're now struggling to pay the balance of this exorbitant and unnecessary testing. Another listener posts on our website says, I find this discussion by the guest doctors very one-sided. My wife is a family practice physician who runs a rural health clinic, and her problems seem very different from those discussed. She doesn't get to have the conversation about waiting for a few days before prescribing antibiotics for sinusitis. Her patients don't have the money for gas to come back down to the office for a second visit if the sinusitis gets worse. My wife just laughed when one of your commentators mentioned that physicians order unnecessary tests because they get reimbursed for them. She has never made a penny on a test she has ordered. In fact, she struggles to get tests for patients. Specialists refuse to take uninsured medical and county medical patients. I think it was country medical patients. Anyway, concludes by saying, maybe this is because the doctors developing the recommendations have been busy treating the 80% of us with insurance and not the 20% of the population that does not have insurance. Dr. Lucy.
You know, I think there's much wisdom in what that caller has to say, and this is exactly the reason why we need to have a better, more sustainable healthcare system so that the healthcare that's needed can be accessed by all of the patients who are suffering and right now suffering without an ability to see a physician or get the care that they need. So I think the caller is right about that. On the other hand, I think there's many ways we can work with our patients to ensure that they get the right care that doesn't continuously inconvenience them. And you're right. We don't want our patients driving back for tests that are unnecessary, but we also don't want them driving to the tests that were unnecessary in the first place. So we need to continue to work as a profession to support those additional patients who need our care.
And Justin, let's bring you on. Good morning. You're on.
Hey, Michael.
Hi.
Great show. I'll try to make this as fast as I can. I had a situation where I went and I had a couple EKGs done, and the EKGs didn't look that good. And I had to get a nuclear test done, lots of radiation, which I didn't like. And then 3 years later, I was back into another doctor. I was living in a different area in Southern California. And, physical again, we did an EKG. He didn't like it. And I said, well, you know, why don't we go through Kaiser? You can look at the first EKG. You can look at that stuff. I really don't want to go through these tests again because I know they're really highly radiated, you know. And, you know, his response was, well, you could die tomorrow. I'm like, geez, man, you know. And so I went through all these tests, and we did a nuclear scan. We did a heart CT scan. That's a lot of radiation. And it turned out that I'm just one of those, I guess, that has false positives. Everything was fine, no worries. But I really felt like the doctor was really pushing me into these things without even you know, suggesting that, yeah, maybe because you had it done a couple of years ago, maybe it is a false positive. Maybe we have a couple of days to at least get these tests back. I don't know. I really felt like he was really pushing me into this thing, and he didn't really listen to my concerns about the radiation, about, you know, the cost. and all that. So,
well, it sounds like you are a perfect example of what we've been hearing from Catherine Lucy about the need for doctors to listen. I mean, for patients to talk, but for doctors to listen.
I agree, and I'm sorry for the experience that you had, because that's not what we set out to accomplish when we become physicians. And I think you're also a perfect example of why this campaign is so important. You had an EKG, and perhaps you didn't even need to have the original EKG, but then it led to this cascade of additional tests, and certainly doing them once might have been appropriate, but repeating them without sort of re-looking at what the results had been in the past is an example of gross waste and inconvenience for you, not alone to not even talk about the radiation exposure, which is considerable with these tests. And if you look at many of the recommendations for the Choosing Wisely campaign, radiation exposure and minimizing that to prevent secondary cancers is a key theme that we see throughout these lists.
Well, here's Judith, who writes, "Oh, please, this is a call for rationing. Denying someone second-line cancer treatment that does provide measurable quality of life and time shows this. Oncologists today already tailor treatments. In addition, there are more expensive cancer drugs not being used now, although they have fewer side effects and may even work better, but patients aren't getting these. This is counterintuitive in that it costs more to treat the side effects. Believe me, the insurance companies are going to jump on this, as they have done in the past, in order to deny tests and treatments." And David Magnus, you say what?
Then nobody is talking about denying treatments that offer benefit to patients. Nobody's talking about denying beneficial palliative chemotherapy or chemotherapies that have a prospect of benefit. All that's being proposed is drawing the line around treatments that offer no benefit to patients, or there's not really clear evidence that they offer benefit to patients and are expensive and even potentially sometimes harmful to patients. So when a patient's failed a first-line, second-line therapy and the probabilities dwindle to zero and a patient's in the dying process and chemotherapy no longer offers any benefit to the patients, that's the time when it's no longer appropriate, and that's what's being talked about here. It's cases where there's consensus among the professional organizations and the physicians in a society that things are not offering benefit to the patients.
Well, let me remind listeners that you can go to our website for the list of 45 overused treatments. Maybe a quick question here from Jenna, who wants to know if there's any link between the excessive tests and treatments in geography, West Coast versus East Coast versus Midwest. Do we know, Dr. Lucy, quickly?
Yeah, there is. And the Dartmouth MAP program has established that across the country there's tremendous variation in the way healthcare resources are used. And that's one of the stimulus for us to take this campaign
nationally. Which region overuses the most?
Coasts. Yeah, the coasts, as opposed to the center of the country.
Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time. Catherine Lucy, Vice Dean for Education, UCSF School of Medicine, who chairs the American Board of Internal Medicine. We also spoke with John Santa earlier, Director of the Health Rating Center for Consumer Reports. And David Magnus joined us, Director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford and also Professor of Pediatrics there. Thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Wouldn't be here without you. An hour's repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, who believe all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.